KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Stanford professor Robert Polk Harrison joins us for a wide-ranging discussion about why the dead matter and how and why we, the living, memorialize them. The dead and how they cohabit the world of the living. Next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Forum. Death shall have no dominion, wrote famed Welsh poet Dylan Thomas. And in his recently published meditation, The Dominion of the Dead, Stanford professor Robert Polk Harrison, and that is Harrison, mind you, not Johnson, argues that, quote, the entire world of the living is permeated by the dead, end quote. All our institutions, law, literature, language, stand, according to Professor Harrison, as living testimony to the importance of the dead to the living. Robert Polk Harrison is the Rosina Pieretti Professor in Italian, and he chairs the Department of French and Italian at Stanford University. He's also the author of The Body of Beatrice and Forests, The Shadow of Civilization, and joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
It's a distinct pleasure.
Well, I don't know how we began talking about this subject. Maybe we go back to the beginning and think about the fact that it may come as a surprise to some of the listeners that before we started inhabiting domiciles and living in homes, we had homes for our dead.
That would seem to be the case, as far as we can know. We're talking about a very long time ago in prehistory, but it would seem that the living first created dwellings to house their dead during the nomadic periods of the in the infancy of the race. And that with the burial of the dead in certain places, they would have a point where they could return. And gradually, if one believes the sort of paleoanthropologist that I do, these burial places became places of residence, houses and then villages and cities and even empires eventually.
And when did graves begin about, as far as we can determine, or grave sites, well, markers, whatever?
One of the claims in my book is that humanity is not a species. Homo sapiens is a species, but humanity is a form of being mortal and is essentially equivalent to burying one's dead. Therefore, the Neanderthals, for example, were not the same species as the Homo sapiens. The fact that they did bury their dead, as far as we can tell, for me qualifies them as humans. So one of the strong claims of my book, I suppose, is that there is no humanity without some form of, if not burial of the body in the ground, at least some sort of ritualization of body disposal. There is no culture known to me on Earth or in history where the disposal of the remains of the dead is a matter of indifference. So I would answer the question by saying I don't know when burial began. It began when humanity began.
It's universal to humanity and continues to be.
I believe that.
It's also, at least one of the things that comes across in your book, is the dominion of human guilt. I mean, if guilt is, as Freud says, in civilization is discontents, maybe the mortar of civilization, then perhaps our obeisance to or our deference to our dead is also part of that mortar.
Well, that's a very perceptive way of putting it. I do try to reconceive guilt as a mode of relations between the living and the dead, especially if you're using the German word Schuld, which has the connotation of debt as well as guilt. The fact is that the living are always indebted to the dead, who are the authors of their worlds, their institutions, the languages that we speak, the laws that have come down to our constitutions. Everything has been authored by them, and therefore the indebtedness is a kind of fact that we start with. And guilt could be conceived as a way of acknowledging this sort of indebtedness. Now, oftentimes, the living have felt that there is no way that one could ever really pay off that debt or become solvent in regard to that debt, and therefore the
answer by one's own mortality.
By one's own mortality, by dying, exactly. So powerful is the hold that the ancestor can have on the human imagination in some cases.
Robert Polk Harrison with us. His book is The Dominion of the Dead. We give them a future so that they may give us a past. I mean, this is part of the thesis of what you write, that you need to find a way forward by looking at that indebtedness or looking at that past and the role that the dead play in our life. Wonderful example of Dante in the Dark Wood, for example, that you use. But it comes back, in a sense, sometimes to just haunt us. I mean, all too often the dead stay with us, and there's a kind of maybe necrophilia that creeps in or some sense of something along those lines.
We want the dead to stay with us in a benevolent mode, if possible, and not be haunters and hounders and harassers of their progeny. And it's true that in many cases, if a mourning process is not completed or has failed, if grief has not found the terms of its articulation, or if the dead somehow feel neglected, unsolicited, unappeased by the living, that there's a way in which they haunt the psyches of the living, and that's not something that we necessarily want.
It's funny you talk about haunting the psyches. I'm reminded of a psychoanalyst named Winnicott who said that the purpose of psychoanalysis is to turn our ghosts into ancestors, which is kind of really nice when you think about it.
Very beautiful. I think an ancestor I could be defined as an appeased ghost, yes, but turned benevolent.
Do we appease our ghosts when we, you know, name streets after them, when we give tributes to them? We have urns with ashes that represent those we love who are cremated, or we feel that we have to go visit the gravesite. Is that an appeasement, or is that simply more of the ritual and recognition of the role they play in our lives? I mean, it can one generalize even about those kinds of things, what motivates?
When we talk about appeasement, it presupposes that the relations between the living and the dead can be antagonistic. And certainly, in many cases, they are. In other cases, it need not be antagonistic, and therefore, it could be just a spontaneous desire to honor, commemorate, share our worlds with the dead, rather than merely appease them through these sort of gestures of placation.
But even when you're honoring and loving, you're also, and being dutiful about the ritual of commemorating the dead, to some extent there's that sense of the separation and the gulf, the chasm between you, the living, and the dead you honor.
I believe that funerals and burial ceremonies and the whole ritual surrounding body disposal serve a dual purpose. One is to effect a separation between the living and the dead, a neat separation, so that each continues to belong to his or her own world. Therefore, the world of the living inhabited by the living and the dead go to their posthumous abode, wherever that might be in the human psyche. So mourning, grieving, burial, funerals, these serve to affect that separation. But one of the results or benefits of a successful separation is that one can now establish relations with the dead on a new footing, which is that of commemoration, honoring, even talking, communion with, in various forms. For example, poetry, where the dead inhabit poems, so many poems, and speak in their own sort of voices, where the poet lends voice to the dead so that they can speak again. All these forms of relationship with the dead, I think, are predicated on somehow first getting them to evacuate our world and inhabit their own world of the dead. And then they can become place names, and they can become the great founding fathers, for example, the authors of the Constitution, become demigods in the imagination, or they can become you know, demigods like Marilyn Monroe or JFK or someone. There, a whole new life opens up for the dead once they become successfully dead, is what I suppose I'm suggesting.
But with new technologies, of course, they still come back to us, as you point out in your book. They come back to us in celluloid, they come back to us in videos and so forth, and they're still here in their words and their kind of flesh and blood.
This is something I don't think we have enough appreciation for. For centuries and millennia, it was primarily the work of poets to descend into the underworld, whether it's Orpheus as the lyric poet, or in the epic tradition, you have Homer, Odysseus going to visit the dead, Aeneas descending into the underworld of Hades to confer with his father and his ancestors. Dante also undertakes a whole journey. And in each case, the poet is lending voice, is allowing the dead to speak, obviously through the poet's voice. But what we don't fail to appreciate enough, in my opinion, is the fact that with the invention of, phonetic recording technologies, for example, the dead were able in the modern era to speak for the first time in their own phonetic voices to us. So now we can hear the speeches of Martin Luther King in his own voice, or Churchill, or the others. Likewise with photography. Prior to photography, there was the portrait, the family portrait, the painted portrait, and prior to that, there was even the death mask, which was like the image of the dead that in noble households in Rome, they would hang those death masks in the atriums of the houses. Prior to the invention of photography, we had painted portraits of ancestors hanging in the halls of bourgeois households. But with the rise of photography now, there was this kind of explosion and proliferation of images of the dead, and one could say that we live in a society nowadays which is completely saturated by the presence of these dead, either through image or through voice and so forth.
Although we're not, it's certainly not, although one hears the indictment, part of your indictment to say that we're a death-obsessed culture. In fact, in some ways you feel maybe we don't give enough deference or veneration to the dead.
The more I reflect on America, the more I think that anything you can say about America, the opposite is equally true, because it's a culture or a nation of such profound contradiction. And so on the one hand, it's completely true that America is probably the one society in the world where death is the most repressed, which is youth-oriented, future-looking, can do without the past, and where the dead have no rights of citizenship in the world. And yet at the same time, it's obvious that we have a manner of venerating our dead or revering them when it comes to, again, I was mentioning earlier, the founding fathers who have this kind of ancestral authority in the culture.
Or Elvis, or Marilyn Monroe. Or
many of the stars, exactly. And we are very good at certain forms of public funerals. I mean, JFK's funeral, no one who was alive at that point will ever forget. This sort of solemn protocols and the way that was conducted. Even recently, Reagan's funeral was another sort of example of how this country can be very good at certain forms of kind of public recognition of the dead.
Well, the reading of names of people who die in Iraq or the Vietnam Memorial. In fact, you go back even to the Gettysburg Address. You spend a good deal of time writing about the Gettysburg Address and just the notion, shall not perish from the earth, the burial place, that sense that these deaths are not in vain, which is a lot of what we do when we commemorate, you know, that the person's life meant something.
Exactly.
What do you think about these new rituals and ceremonies where people celebrate the life rather than, you know, say that this is a mourning or a bereavement ceremony or has anything to do with grieving? They try to make it into joy, really. And I'm not trying to make it calculate an opinion here, but what do you think?
Well, it doesn't bother me. I don't think it's that exceptional either. There are plenty of traditional cultures where the death was something to be celebrated, or the life of the person who had deceased was, and also an occasion for wild feasts, parties, and the Irish are very good at that tradition with the wake and the drinking and so forth. I think what's important is marking the event in a communal way, in a way where the bereaved, the loved ones, don't have to suffer their bereavement in a kind of isolated solitude. So whether it takes the form of this kind of joyful celebration of the life of the dead, or solemn grieving for the passage of the dead, it's the public nature of the ceremony, I think, which is serves a therapeutic purpose.
You also write about you write about the differences in religious and secular grieving and rituals with death, and how the Roman Catholic Church was built really on the bones of Peter, and needs relics of saints to be consecrated. And I was thinking, do you have a notion why it is, for example, that Jews traditionally name after the dead and Christians after the living?
I'm not sure I do. Do you have
I asked you because you know, you've thought so much and so inclusively about this.
Struck
by that.
You know. Yeah, Christianity, you know, began as a sect of Judaism.
Right.
There was no such distinction until later. So, what I can say is that the authority and power of the dead in Judaism, from what I know, is enormous. As huge as it is in any culture, such that it's from the ancestors that come the commandments and the injunctions and the I do mention this paradoxical situation in Israel a few years ago when the archaeologists were uncovering ancient graves, the Hebrew graves, in order to show that, hey, we had been in this land. The more evidence they could uncover archaeologically that the Jews had once lived in that land, the more they thought they were legitimizing their claims to the state of Israel. But the rabbis were the ones who were up in arms and were calling for a halt to these excavations because...
Violating the dead. It's like Indians with burial lands, the same thing.
Well, exactly, yeah. They have their place, and by profaning the tombs, the archaeologists were actually undermining the very claims of legitimacy that they wanted to prove. You see, and so it was very beautiful.
But there is certainly, I mean, among all the different faiths, different responses to how the dead need to be memorialized and how they need to be treated. And I suspect you can find, in fact, connections to the articles of each religion in terms of faith to how they treat their dead. Kind of a fair generalist statement that we learn a lot about each religion in the way it treats its dead.
Definitely. I think that's one of the clearest indications of what the creeds are of that religion. So, for example, the Christians were resurrected a very old practice, which was inhumation of the dead rather than cremation of the dead. Inhumation is when you place the body directly into the earth in a coffin. And the Greeks and Romans were typically cremating their dead, and then they were burying the ashes in an urn someplace. But it was because the Christians believed in the resurrection of the body that there was a proscription against cremation, for example. So that really confirms the thesis that the way the Greeks and the Romans dealt with their dead, one could say that their religions were really founded on the practice of ancestor worship in ways, and grief was supposed to be publicly displayed in very dramatic ways. Again,
women, I'm thinking of, you know, jumping into the Ganges, and that's, I mean, it's very... Yeah. Different, connected to, again, to the religious tradition and the cultural traditions, you know?
Sure, and the ululations and lamentations, yeah. And the whole externalization, which, again, in Christianity, I know that there were a lot of proscriptions against an excessive display of grief because these kind of public, they were indicative of despair. It means that you didn't believe enough in the afterlife of heaven, that the deceased had gone to a better place than earth. So if you were carrying on in such extravagant ways in public, So for sure, these practices reveal a great deal about the creeds.
I was also thinking of like Shiite Muslims self-flagellating,
yes,
and all of these kinds of rituals, really, that have to do, again, with honoring the dead or with bringing the dead into one's life, which is, of course, what your book is all about. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact, I've been to gravesites, and you see people talking at gravesites. I mean, people who may not even be believers or may not even have a faith, but they feel the necessity to pour out their heart at, I mean, you see it at iconic grave sites. I mean, people going to make this hegira or whatever it is to places like Jim Morrison's grave or whatever.
That's know? Right.
And they talk to the dead. It's a curious phenomenon, but it's universal in many ways, isn't it?
They talk to the dead. They leave notes to the dead and flowers and feed the dead often, favorite cookies and things of this sort.
And then you see these monuments to, like, a child will be abducted, and you find that the child has been killed, or a gang member shooting in a neighborhood and the kid is killed. And flowers and dolls and, you know, all of these kinds of things has become a regular ritual.
It has. It's, again, I think you're right to say that in many cases people don't believe any longer in what was the literal belief when these practices first originated. So, for example, at a certain point, early on, people literally believed that the dead continued to have a substantive existence under the ground and therefore were in need of nourishment. And so there were, every month there was the day when one would go to the gravesite and feed the dead. One would even bore holes into the ground so that the cereals or the milk and the honey and things could reach the dead, you know, more effectively. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the whole principle of agriculture were not discovered through this practice of feeding the dead, where, I mean, if you're giving all those grains and foods and water to your ancestor, at a certain point that gravesite is going to flower into some kind of lush garden of some sort. But that's a different issue. We no longer believe, most of us no longer believe, that the dead actually maintain a life of sorts at the gravesite. And yet,
I quote Dylan Thomas, everyone, again, after the first death, there is no other.
After the first death, there is no. Yeah, I'm glad you cited the, and death shall have no dominion. That is one of the allusions to the title. But again, these are cultural practices that continue. The visitation of graves continues even though we don't believe that the dead have a life there. And yet there is a charisma. You mentioned Jim Morrison. I was there in Père Lachaise not too long ago, and all these young people who otherwise would never visit a cemetery, you know, on an overcast day in Paris, they were all there for one purpose, to pay their respects to that one place. And so one has to ask, what wouldn't it be a shame if Morrison had, you know, decreed that he just wanted his ashes strewn in the Seine or some other place where there would not be such a marker?
Talking with Robert Polk Harrison, he is Rossina Pieretti, professor in Italian literature and chairs the Department of French and Italian at Stanford, and his newest book is called The Dominion of the Dead. I'd like to invite you to join this conversation, and a fascinating one it is. We welcome your calls, and phones are available to you, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can join us now, wherever you're listening to us, or however, on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. And you can also communicate to us by email. If you have questions or comments for our guest, please do so by email at forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Excuse me. We're talking with Robert Polk Harrison, the author of The Dominion of the Dead, and Rossina Pieretti, professor in Italian literature at Stanford. He chairs the Department of French and Italian there. His other books include Forests, The Shadow of Civilization, and The Body of Beatrice. And just a quick question before we go to callers here. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, we do welcome your calls at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emails forum@kqed.org. Talk a lot about the difference between how we ritualize death in terms of deaths in the land and burials in the land and deaths at sea and in the water. I mean, with those two different elements. And I'm struck now in the wake of New Orleans and this horror that we've seen, just about how we ritualize the dead and what you've seen or observed about that, particularly since it was really overcome by water.
Yeah. Well, commemoration of the dead presupposes that there is an earth on which, in which, let's say, one can bury the dead, on which one can place a marker, and an earth that will preserve the traces of the past in time into the future. There's a huge discrepancy between the earth and the sea in this regard. The sea is literally uninscribable. You cannot mark any spot on it. And therefore, the trauma of the loved ones who have lost their people at sea is very acute, the way it's described in Moby Dick, for example, in the Whaleman's Chapel, where there are all these marble inscriptions in memory of these. And Melville or Ishmael says, blessed are you who have your dead nearby in the green plot where you can go and be near by the dead, as opposed to these widows whose, you know, their husbands are dying at sea, where there's no grave is made possible. And there's something about we tend to forget that the sea is a very terrifying element, precisely because all of our culture, society, and history is predicated on the earth, on the element of the earth. And floods are very, they have primordial resonance in our psyches. I think many ancient cultures have, you know, the story of the flood. We have it in
Gilgamesh and Noah.
Gilgamesh and Noah, and the Hittites had a version and so forth. And there's always this sense that at a certain point, the sea could in an instant completely obliterate everything that has to do with our humanity just by effacing all traces of the earth, just by submerging the earth. And in New Orleans, we had only a little kind of intimation, or in Louisiana, about what kind of calamity, you know, that represents, where it's now the whole story is under siege when the sea decides to flood. We saw it in the tsunami as well.
It's also difficult to, for those, of course, who lose loved ones, think about the desaparados in Argentina, for example, and those where there's no corpse. Yeah. One can't find a corpse. And people who, I mean, that was, you know, I think part of the fascination, I think, about this, and the morbid fascination as well as the sensationalism of the whole Scott Peterson thing, was the inability to find a corpse, although people knew and suspected that the woman had been murdered. Let me go to our calls. And John, you're first up. Good morning.
Yes, good. Thank you. Fascinating show. If you'll give me 3 points, I'd like to make three questions. One is, I was very fascinated by the phrase, I think you heard it at the beginning from the professor, the infancy of grace. And I wondered what that would mean. Second thing is, in the American military, probably militaries from other countries, the soldiers are assured, we will recover you. If you go out on the battlefield and you die, we'll recover your remains. Of course, we'll pick you up if you're injured, too. And I think that's quite important, because then the soldier knows that in some very basic, beyond the grave sense, he'll be taken care of. And it's, or there's a belongingness there. I will be treated with respect when and if I die on the battlefield. And that comes down to regular old civilians, too. I know.
So we have a grave of the unknown soldier, in fact, for all those who can't be brought back. Yeah,
that's right. So no matter what, he will be treated with dignity in death. And that comes back to you and me. I know, I'm pretty sure when I die, there will be a funeral service, a memorial service, and people will say nice things. It gives me a tremendous sense of belonging. So much of this, I think, has to do with the person's sense of belonging to his culture and the sense of belonging to something bigger than himself. So I'd just like to hear some commentary on those ideas.
All right. We thank you for those. Of course, I was thinking about that scene in Huckleberry Finn where he gets to watch his own funeral, you know, and really enjoys it immensely. I think every adolescent goes through that kind of fantasy. Infancy of grace?
I must not have been very clear. I was saying the infancy of the race.
That's
the
what
human
I thought
race.
You were saying, yes.
Yeah, infancy of the human race. Sorry about that. On the question of the soldiers and the recovery of the body, this is very interesting, and I appreciated that comment. It goes back to the very beginnings of warfare. The real fear, if you read Homer, the beginning of the Iliad, the very first lines of the Iliad allude to the prospect of dying on the battlefield and having one's body eaten by vultures and dogs rather than being repatriated and brought back home and wept and buried properly. It was almost more terrifying to die unburied for a Greek than it was to die, and even for seamen. And we have figures of the undead in when Odysseus goes to visit the dead, he sees Palinurus, who hasn't been buried, and you cannot cross over into Hades. It was a condition of permanent exile for those people, and therefore I think that even nowadays promising the soldiers that their bodies will be recovered is a source of great reassurance to those who are going to go into battle, because still today there's something, as the caller was suggesting, a sense of belonging to a community, and part of that belonging is what the community will do for you in your decease.
And what your loved ones will be able to do if they have your remains or if they have your corpse to inter you and to honor you. And let me go to more of your calls. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. My question was for the author, when he's speaking about the dead and their needs. Now, I understand when he's talking about other cultures, he's talking about their beliefs, but what are his beliefs? I mean, is he speaking metaphorically, or does he still believe that, you know, the dead have certain needs that need to be fulfilled? And I guess the follow-up to that is, if he does believe that, well, you know, what about earlier talked about, I think, Neanderthal man being human because they treated their dead, you know, as more than just discarded material. Well, nobody remembers them anymore. Nobody knows anything about them. They're gone. So what does that mean for their dead?
All right,
and I'll take my answers off the line.
Right, well, thank you for the call. First part, reminded me a little about Senator Feinstein quizzing John Roberts. But what do you feel? Well, what do you feel, Professor Harrison?
The caller is right to point to this ambiguity, which I try to maintain in the book as well as on air, which is to personify the dead as you know, living entities that have certain needs. And I'm not quite prepared to say that I'm speaking only metaphorically. Clearly, I speak metaphorically. And for the most part, when I speak about the needs of the dead and so forth, I'm speaking about the needs of the psyches of those who have survived them and the loved ones. But at the same time, there's a reason why one should personify the dead, because all cultures seem to teach the same lesson that that whatever the needs of the dead are, they are human needs of, among the living. So why not talk as if these were real personified entities? So the second query that he had to do with, okay, no one remembers the dead of the Neanderthal. But no one is saying that the dead have a permanent, eternal afterlife. The dead have an afterlife only to the extent to which the living have a memory of them. At least a secular, in my book, I'm not interested in what other kinds of afterlife the dead may or may not have in non-secular places. I'm interested only in the afterlife the dead have in our world. And in our world, it's only to the degree that the living keep them alive that they remain alive. The fact that the last Neanderthal died a long time ago means that all of his ancestors died with him as well.
Robert Polk Harrison, our guest, and more of your calls. By the way, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 if you have something you'd like to contribute to the conversation or bring to our attention. And our email address is forum@kqed.org. On we go to Teresa in Palo Alto. Good morning.
I am a hospice nurse here in the peninsula, and I found a funny trend with a lot of the caregivers that I work with that are often from the Pacific Islands or Philippines, that they often are very reluctant to take care of or go into the room of once a person has died, a patient has died, to do the post-mortem care. And even after the patient has been removed from that room, they don't want to go into that wing. They're reluctant or afraid. And I'm wondering how I can help, or maybe you could shed some light on the beliefs around that culture.
Well, there's Martin Heidegger is a German philosopher that wrote his first book, Being in Time, about how being unto death is a necessary sort of existential aspect of all human beings. And he made a huge blunder to suggest that the corpse, I mean, a dead person, the corpse is nothing but a thing like any other thing. It now belongs to the things of the world. And I believe very profoundly that a corpse is a highly uncanny, haunted kind of thing. It is the... I'm trying to explain why there would be such reactions. The corpse is the perfect likeness of the person who has left its mass. And one has to imagine, they say, well, here's my mother. It looks like my mother. It is my mother. It's the same body as my mother. And where is my mother? Mm-hmm. And the corpse still holds the person, and yet at the same time denies that person. So a corpse is a very in-between kind of thing. It's in between the world of the living and the world of the dead. That's why I think we have to bury them.
Because it's also why in many, I remember going through the ritual of looking at my mother as a corpse and having just that bizarre sensation of presence and absence combined that you just, I think, so nicely phrased it. You mentioned Heidegger, and there's actually somebody who... I can't remember who it was. You may remember one of the reviewers of your book, because I did look at some of the reviews as well. Talking about Heidegger as a major force in philosophy in terms of the way he compels us to think about death and the role it plays in human affairs. But then he went on to suggest that maybe one shouldn't become too interested in or engaged by Heidegger because that thinking can lead to Nazism. And I thought I wasn't clear on the concept. I mean, how Heidegger's relationship with death or what he believes about death goes into Teutonic burials or notions of Aryan superiority. I mean, I know he flirted with Nazism, but I didn't quite understand where the jump was there. I mean,
well, you know, it's a highly debated and discussed topic about whether Heidegger's thinking, especially, you know, prior to 1930, in this text I'm referring to, Being and Time, whether there was something in his philosophy which was consonant with and sympathetic with the doctrines of Nazism. And I think it's an unresolved issue. Certainly, in Being and Time, there is a kind of heroism of being unto death with open eyes, without evasion. And there is also a sense that one has to take complete personal responsibility for one's existence, which then some people argue Heidegger later, you know, about 8 years later, was able to translate into the Nazi call for, devotion to the fatherland, heroism and sacrifice and so on and so forth. Whether I don't exactly have a position on that. My engagement with Heidegger and where I find that his thinking has limitations is the fact that he speaks always very abstractly, and he never gives an anthropological density to his abstractions.
You also provide a kind of solution to some of those abstractions in Vico.
Yes, exactly. Vico is really much more than Heidegger, the kind of ancestor whom I claim, whose legacy I would like to claim for myself. Because Vico said that philosophy... the philosophers fail by half by not appealing to the authority of what he called the philologians, or we would call them, to say, the anthropologists. And the anthropologists fail by half by not paying attention to the reasoning of the philosophers. And he wrote this book called The New Science in the mid-18th century, where he tried to create an alliance between what he called philosophy and philology, which I take to be the model of what I try to do, where if you're going to talk about being towards death, well, why don't we start by talking about what it means to be towards the dead? The dead are concrete. They're personified entities. Death is an abstraction. We're all going to... Death is... there's no distinction between one and the other, whereas the dead, now we start getting specific. I have my dead. You have your dead. My neighbor has his or her dead. And... It requires a different kind of analysis. So Vico was very important for the kind of model book I wanted to write.
Our guest, Robert Polk Harrison, his book is The Dominion of the Dead, and we go next to Reed. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I had a question. I've heard about, you know, a lot about the earth and a lot about the ocean and almost kind of denigration of a burial in the ocean, but I'm wondering if the author's come across the Tibetan practice of a sky burial and what his comment might be on that.
I know about the sky burials, and they're quite fascinating, the aerial burials. It's I don't have any particular insight to offer, except to say that it's just one more confirmation of the fact that in one form or another, body disposal takes ritualistic forms in human cultures, and that's one form. I would imagine a very beautiful form, although I've never witnessed it in person.
Wasn't that what Hunter Thompson wanted to do?
Yes. Well, he wanted to be shot out of a cannon.
Yeah, exactly. Or his ashes or whatever. Thank you for that call, Reed, and let me get more of your calls here. And next, Robert, morning. You're on forum.
Yeah, great discussion. Very, very good discussion. Death and its ritualization. Very, very interesting. Hey, I'm wondering, the author, like, I've traveled into Egypt a lot, and I've read a lot of their mortuary texts, you know, the books of coming forth by day into the night, the books of the Amduat, the Purim Ru, the pyramid text, the coffin text, et cetera, et cetera. And in my opinion, I just think that there hasn't been a civilization before or since that had a full-fledged understanding of the lost science of the immortality of the human soul as the ancient Egyptians did. And it was a beautiful science that evolved around, you know, the immortality of the human soul and how to achieve that. Dealing more in the metaphysical realm rather than in the Western world where it was more physically oriented. So I was wondering if you have come across any of their works or have read any of their works and what your opinion was on those, and I'll take my answer on the air.
All right, we thank you for the call, Robert.
I, you know, the Book of the Dead is a big text, and that's the one I know. I'm not familiar with the ones that were cited there on air, but certainly the caller is correct to say that probably the cult of the dead or the afterlife will never be paralleled as it was in ancient Egypt, where the pyramids. What are the pyramids? I mean, they're basically tombs. They're houses for the dead pharaohs, where
Ozymandias.
Yes.
No, but I'm also thinking about, obviously King Tut and all those. I mean, preserved through centuries and centuries.
Centuries. And there was a completely literal belief in a thriving life after death for these people, so that they would send their servants down with them, their horses, their swords, their goods, and their jewelry, all that for the enjoyment, the delectation of the dead person in the afterlife. And in a sense, it's a very joyous culture, the Egyptian, in that sense. They're not haunted, very unlike the Assyrians or the Babylonians. If you read Gilgamesh, it's tremendously depressing and pessimistic view of the underworld. Not so with the Egyptians. There's a real joyous affirmation. I think the caller is right to bring attention to that.
Greeks and the Romans had a pretty dark view of the underworld, too. I mean, literally and figuratively.
Yes, they did. When Odysseus visits the dead in Book 11 of the Odyssey, and he's speaking to Achilles, and he's trying to console Achilles for his early death. And Achilles says, you know, cut it out, Odysseus. Don't try to console me for death. I would rather be a slave in the light, you know, for a day than the lord of all the dead. Therefore, all the honor and glory I've achieved through my early death is really not worth it, because life is what they love. The Greeks were real lovers of life. Therefore, nothing really could console them for the state of being disembodied. And the Romans were not. The Romans were less, let's say, pessimistic, but not in no way like the Egyptians. This kind of sheer affirmation.
Robert Polk Harrison, it's been a fascinating discussion, and thank you so much for being with us. We are going to be back for our regular listenership. We're actually going to pledge, but we'll be back for those of you who are listening to us on Sirius or beyond. And I want to remind you, of course, that the book that we're talking about is the newest book by Professor Harrison. It's called The Dominion of the Dead. We'll continue taking calls and talking to those of you who are on the line who are listening to us on Sirius Satellite. But I also want to mention that Professor Harrison has also written a book called The Body of Beatrice and Forests, The Shadow of Civilization. And he is Rosina Pieretti, professor in Italian literature and chairs the Department of French and Italian at Stanford. And your erudition and your immersion in literature certainly comes through in this book and serves you very well.
Thank you.
Talking about everything from Homer to the Cantos and even beyond. Are you going to be appearing, going to be reading or anything in the Bay Area?
I have nothing scheduled at this moment.
Okay.
But you can hear me on the waves.
Well, mention that. Yeah, Stanford, yeah?
Yeah, I've just started my own radio show. My department is sponsoring a radio show that I'm hosting, which is a literary talk show once a week where I figured that there are so many interesting people and smart people at Stanford, and we're like Dante's limbo. We have all these intellectuals and poets and things, and I figured that we have a daily feast of conversation. So we're going to, let people in on that once a week by talking about various works of literature, from everything from Homer to Saul Bellow, depending on who the guest is, on KZSU 90.1 FM on Tuesdays 5 to 6.
A plug for a competitive broadcaster. I wish you good luck with that. Sounds like fun. And you're listening to KQED Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. And now we're back from Pledge to the Sirius Satellite and beyond, and Cullen is joining us. Hi, Cullen.
Hi, Michael. I just wanted to mention more of the pantheist point of view, as so eloquently described by Robinson Jeffers in his poem Vulture, where he talks about being eaten by a vulture, being eaten by that beak and becoming a part of him, and to share those wings and those eyes, what a sublime end of one's body, what an ensconcement. What a life after death.
What a view of misanthropy that is perfectly consistent with Robinson Jeffers, but I understand what you're saying.
Right. Well, there does seem something kind of like a collective narcissism about having ourself continue. And I can appreciate in the memories of the people that cared for us, but there does seem to be a misplaced amount of meaning on it. And I wanted to kind of challenge your guest to expand a little bit on the pantheist point of view. Thank you. I'll take my...
Stay on here because...
Okay.
Well, I actually am very sympathetic towards it. In Ovid's Metamorphosis is another classical work, which is very un-Virgilian, and it's very much in the tradition that the caller is referring to, where human beings die, and through their death, they become the flora and fauna and other animals of the world. And there's this kind of material continuum where basically the premise is that we all share the same basic substance, material, physical substance. And it's only our forms which differentiate us. Therefore, if you have a human form or an animal form or a plant form or even a mineral form, that's really secondary to the basic. And that is also a way of saying that death actually is not a reality. Death is a change of appearance. There's something very beautiful about that.
Reassuring, too.
Yes, but it doesn't always answer to the very felt human grief that takes place when a loved one dies and one is violently deprived from one day to the next of a companion or a loved one. So it's I think it's more consoling in idea than in reality.
Well, when my father died, the whole process of what I call death custody, where they whisked his body away and into the funeral home and formaldehyde and all that, it was so repulsive to me. It was like I didn't really want to participate in it, and it was somehow I felt like it was an opportunity for me to get in touch with this deeper part of myself that was also related to him in more of a profound way than it would be if I, went to his tombstone or the open coffin. And it was just something very personal for me. I just kind of question the notion that that works for everyone.
I appreciate your call, Colin. Thank you for that. And let's try to get one more call on here. And Charles, morning.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I have a different point of view about all this. For one thing, I don't give a whip what they do with my cadaver after I kick off. I carry a card so that my body can be donated to medical science. They can open me up and find out how I tick. But I've had several close calls. I was once in a delirious coma for about 3 weeks. Later on, during World War II, I narrowly missed being killed while other people were dying around me. And then my latest incident has been adverse drug reactions. I had a very adverse reaction. I fainted several times. One morning, I fainted early in the morning when the ambulance came. They hooked up a gadget to me, and they worked like a devil to get a pulse.
Robert, forgive me. We're fading here. We're coming to the end of things.
Is this better? My voice is rather hoarse.
Yeah. No, it's fine, but can you wrap up your thought?
I can.
I'm sorry. We're flat out of time here. We got a little pinpointed there, and Robert wanted to tell a story, which people want to do, about near death and coming close to death and all that. The book, again, is The Dominion of the Dead. Robert Pogue Harrison is the author. He is professor at Stanford, Rossina Piaretti, professor in Italian literature and chair of the Department of French and Italian. So nice to have you with us, and really so illuminating to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Other hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum's producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. And our engineer is Howard Gelman. Executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of today's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.